Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. I think I should begin by quoting a sign which appears on the tin shed, which does duty as a passenger terminal at an airstrip of a certain South Pacific airline. It says, "Hello, sound. Is the sound system working?" Yes, I'm told it's working. Well, I'll do the best I can with whatever assistance the technician there can provide me. I'm giving the signal to turn it up a bit. The sign which I commend to you on the wall of the shed, which does duty as an air passenger terminal for a certain South Pacific airline, says, "Lower your expectations and raise your appreciation." I'd like you to take that instruction on board. One of my predecessors, Rupert Loof, retired in 1965 at the age of 65 and then lived to the age of 102 years. When he was in his 90s, he was being pursued by the National Library for an interview under their oral history program, and he kept on telling them that he would grant them an interview in the fullness of time. I thought this showed a rather reckless disregard for the rights of posterity. And I decided that I wouldn't wait for another 35 years before setting down some thoughts about changes in the parliamentary institution over that time. I should say that he did eventually give an interview, which was extremely useful. When you look back over a period of time like that, you tend to identify long-term trends, and they achieve a certain air of inevitability about them, which is a well-known problem for historians. But one of the things that impresses me looking back over that period is the number of things that were determined by pure chance and having rather strange individuals in funny places at the right time. I'm always reminded of that biblical quotation, you know, the race is not to the swift nor the battle to the strong, etc., but time and chance happen to them all. There certainly appears to me to have been a great deal of chance involved, and particularly funny people in the place at the right time. I think the most significant change over that period has been what I'd call the end of the Westminster hegemony. When I first came here, all constitutional, procedural and institutional questions were argued in terms of the Westminster model. What is the proper Westminster model for dealing with these things? Whatever was allegedly done at Westminster should be our infallible guide. Fortunately, those appeals often produced very contradictory results. Gough Whitlam once described the Australian Parliament as a British Parliament and was quite fond of appealing to Westminster practices. He appealed to the Westminster model on two memorable occasions. One was to call upon the Gorton government to resign when its budget was defeated in the Senate, because the opposition, of which he was then the leader, intended to vote against the budget. Subsequently, he appealed to the Westminster model to maintain the budget should never be defeated in the Senate. So, fortunately, the Westminster model produced those contradictory results. But it had great authority, and it's a very interesting question as to how this came about. When Australia first got started, the people who framed the Constitution were very well aware that they had chosen, for good or ill, and some of them thought it was ill, a very un-British system of government. And those who were most responsible for it were very insistent that we had a non-British system of government. And in particular, one of the most prominent framers, Richard Baker, who later became first President of the Senate, was very insistent that we should not follow British patterns and should develop our own, because we had a different constitution. And while he was in office, he was quite successful in enforcing that principle during the first 10 years or so of the Commonwealth. But by about 1920, the Westminster hegemony was well and truly established, and it's a question of what historical and cultural factors brought that about, which I won't go into now, but it's an interesting question. Nowadays, appeals to Westminster are much less frequent, and certainly they don't have the authority that they used to have. We've now got to referring to our own system of government and our own practices and general principles of governance that should apply, and I think that is a good thing. The first shift away from the Westminster hegemony occurred a long time ago, when it might be thought to have been at its height, in 1970 with the establishment of the Senate committee system. But it's very difficult to appreciate this now because every old House of Parliament has a standing committee system. That's not at all unusual. But it was a very radical step to take at the time. I have to say that a lot of the committee systems of houses around the place are, not to put too fine a point on, fake systems insofar as they're very firmly under the control of the government of the day. And in particular, they get the subjects of their inquiry from ministers. They're only permitted to inquire into things that ministers give them, and ministers draft their terms of reference. But the Senate system was and is and was always intended to be a system which would allow the Senate to inquire into things that the Senate wanted to inquire into. I should mention that good old Westminster didn't get a comprehensive standing committee system until 1979. Although its committees display what we would regard as a remarkable degree of independence, complaints are frequently made there that it's too much under executive control and domination. But the Senate, because of the independence of the Senate system enables inquiries to be conducted into things other than those determined by the government. And a very wise old senator, who I'll mention again later, used to say that the subjects most worthy of parliamentary inquiry are those that the government would rather you didn't inquire into. And that this is the system, this is the principle that the system should operate on. As a result of the system, one house of our parliament was equipped with the equipment to conduct inquiries into all matters of public interest, regardless of whether government wanted those inquiries or not. That the establishment of the committee system in 1970 was a very radical step, I think is best illustrated by the very firm resistance that was put up to it going back to long before that time. In 1955, another of my predecessors, the great Odgers, the Odgers of the book, won a scholarship and went to Washington to study the congressional committee system. I think it's very significant that he didn't make the compulsory pilgrimage to Westminster that was the thing for Commonwealth clerks to do in those days, but instead chose to go to that other place. And I think that showed an awareness on his part that our system was always intended to be different. On his return, he composed a report which was tabled in the Senate, and it recommended a comprehensive congressional-style committee system for the Australian Senate. He was very tolerantly patted on the head by the powers that be of the time and told this was very commendable and very understandable that he should want to bring about improvements in the institution he served, but he had to be patient and he had to hasten slowly with these things. In fact, the powers that be had no intention of making any such change. And both governments and oppositions were rather content with the good old Westminster executive-dominated system and were content to see the occasional nuisance role of the Senate as a historical anomaly. But Odgers didn't give up, and after he became clerk in 1965, he prepared another report on the subject, which he provided to the Senate President and to the government. It was referred to the Cabinet as the supreme decision-making body of the country and the Parliament. Nothing could happen in Parliament without the approval of the Cabinet, where it quietly perished. Thanks to the 30-year rule, we know exactly what the powers that be thought of the proposal at the time. The Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, Sir John Bunting, advised the government that Odger's proposal would be erosive of government authority and would undermine the sacred tenets of responsible government. Unfortunately, he couldn't spell the word erosive. His lack of spelling ability is preserved forevermore in those documents. But while he couldn't spell, he knew what he was about. He knew how to preserve the good old Westminster system, and in his correspondence, he none too subtly suggested that perhaps some action should be taken about this meddlesome clerk who was putting forward these subversive proposals. You have to remember that in those days, the appointment to the job was made by the Governor-General with the approval of the government. So Odgers was skating on very thin ice. But some years later, 1969, the time had come. The time had come for this idea. And it's well known that this had a great deal to do with the presence of one of those strange characters that I referred to before, in the right place at the right time, Lionel Murphy. Murphy succeeded in convincing his party that the establishment of a committee system in the Senate was in the party's best interests and a desirable reform for the Parliament to pursue. That was an amazing achievement, getting his party to adopt that policy, because, of course, the Labor Party had a very traditional hostility to upper houses, it was not in accordance with their general ideological bent to allow the Senate to improve its role in the parliamentary system. In fact, for many years, of course, they had a plank in their platform for the abolition of the Senate. And generally speaking, the party tended to be very comfortable with the Westminster system and the total power it delivered to the executive of the day. Murphy really was a strange character. He's remembered as a member of the extreme left of the party and as a militant opponent of American foreign policy, and particularly the Vietnam War. But it's not generally appreciated that he was actually an Americophile, if that's the correct term, an admirer of all things American, and particularly an admirer of the congressional system. I always thought he would have been quite at home in the, say, the left wing of the Democratic Party in Washington, from New Hampshire or somewhere like that. And paradoxically, this admiration for things congressional was only reinforced by the dispute over the Vietnam War. When I worked in the Parliamentary Library, Murphy was a regular customer. He was always seeking the latest transcripts of hearings of congressional committees in Washington, and a great deal of effort was gone to get these things as fast as possible. Of course, in the absence of email and the internet, it was difficult to get hold of them. But what he was looking for was the latest exposés in these congressional hearings of the failings of the conduct of the Vietnam War. And in a long series of hearings right through the 1960s, the congressional leaders of those committees ruthlessly and relentlessly exposed the failings of the administration in the conduct of the war. And this was mightily impressive to Murphy. It was a great lesson in the virtues of the congressional system. But more importantly, it was an extremely valuable thing for the an Australian opposition leader to follow, because quite often the Australian government would adopt some position on the Vietnam War and put forward some facts supporting this position, and then you would have a congressional hearing which would reveal that the United States government had abandoned those positions and declared that those facts were actually false. So the government here was constantly undermined by the those congressional probes of the war. And I've always thought if you're going to be a province of a great empire, it's best not to be in a situation where the legislature of the imperial government has more open and transparent processes of legislative scrutiny than you have. But that was the situation that we were in. So Murphy was very keen on promoting a committee system for the Senate, and due to his efforts in converting his party and his notable charm, for which he was famous, Odgers was asked to do a paper on the subject. He'd learned the lesson of his experiences in the 1950s and 60s, he avoided all reference to his earlier report and the congressional model. In fact, he instructed his colleagues not to refer to that report. or to anything to do with Washington, if they could possibly avoid it, lest the powers that be were alarmed by the step they were being asked to undertake. In his first paper, he proposed a series of committees on neglected subjects and innocuous subjects that governments could not possibly object to. But Murphy was not satisfied with this. He told Odgers to go for the big one, as he put it. So Odgers prepared a second paper in which he outlined a comprehensive system of standing committees able to inquire into any subject, going back to his original 1955 proposal, which now appeared was not like the proverbial pork chop in the synagogue, but was actually on the verge of political acceptance. Still and all, we maintained a pretense that this change would not involve a radical departure from the Westminster system, and in the papers that were done on the subject, innocuous places such as New Zealand and Canada were referred to and their committee systems, and it was all generally played low-key. In effect, the whole operation was based on a rather mild deception. But in the meantime, the then government was under pressure from its own backbenchers to enhance the Senate's committee role. They had developed a taste for committee work during the 50s and 60s by the appointment of a number of select committees, and at the same time they were looking for a better method of dealing with the government's budget than asking questions of ministers in the chamber, who then referred the questions to departmental people sitting in the advisers' box. In those days, government backbenchers used to ask probing questions about government expenditure, and this was a very tedious method of dealing with it. So the government was forced to put forward an alternative proposal, and it put forward a proposal for estimates committees which would conduct hearings into the estimates at each budget time. This proposal was a pretty radical proposal too, and it wasn't appreciated by those who supported it how radical it was, because of course it involved public servants coming before committees and directly answering questions about government expenditure, which created a situation where there was no end to the information that could be gained by the Parliament vis-a-vis the executive. So the two proposals went forward, and then another one of those peculiar characters comes to the fore, a very strange character, by the name of Ian Wood, a Liberal from Queensland, who was famous and notorious for voting against his government whenever he thought they were doing something wrong. And nobody told him this was a very un-Westminster thing to be doing. He supported both proposals. He loyally supported the government proposal, but he also supported the opposition proposal, as of which they both got up by one vote, and so the Senate gained the committee system. That story may be known to some of you, although it has some unknown twists to it, but I think what is not generally known is that having gained that committee system and operated for it under a number of years, the system was very nearly rendered ineffective in 1987. Soon after the government was returned in that election, there was a strange delay in ministers moving the necessary motions to reappoint the standing committees. And people became very suspicious about this delay. In the meantime, the government had announced that it would support the establishment of a standing committee system in the House of Representatives. This system was to be very firmly under government control, because ministers were to make the references to the committees. At this stage, the government's enthusiasm for committee systems had somewhat waned. Murphy, of course, had departed, and it was forgotten about him making a powerful committee system a plank in the party's platform. Ironically enough, the waning enthusiasm for committees might have had something to do with the inquiries in 1984 by two Senate committees into the conduct of Mr. Justice Murphy, as he then became the first inquiries conducted by a House of the Parliament into a possible removal of a judge under section 72 of the Constitution. But in any case, be that as it may, government had come to the conclusion that committees should not be free-range animals, but feedlot animals, kept under very close supervision. So there were rumours going about that the Senate committee system was going to be nobbled, that some plot was afoot. When the necessary motions were put forward, the plot was there for all to see who were sufficiently discerning. The motion provided for the Senate committees to have their names changed and their areas of responsibility changed so that they would exactly mirror the committee system that the government was proposing for the House of Representatives. And then there was a little provision in there that said the Senate committees could meet as joint committees with the House of Representatives committees. It was glaringly obvious to those of us who have been around for a while that the purpose of this was to gradually merge the Senate committee system into a system of joint committees, which of course would be very firmly under government control. Fortunately, there were some more of those peculiar characters around at the time. One was David Hamer, a Liberal senator from Victoria, a very eccentric character, former naval officer, used to be nicknamed the Admiral, who was the source of those sage words I quoted earlier about the best inquiries are those that governments don't want. And he rallied the opposition to these proposals for the Senate committee system. And he was supported by another odd character by the name of Michael Macklin, who was still alive, so I can't say too much about his oddities. He was a Democrat from Queensland and a character who had a very strong interest in making the executive more accountable and making Parliament more effective. He told me later on that all his efforts for greater executive accountability and parliamentary effectiveness did him absolutely no good in the electorate whatsoever. When the motions for the appointment of the committees were moved, Macklin moved a little amendment which said that the Senate committees could meet as joint committees with the House committees with the approval of the Senate. This meant that every time a joint meeting was proposed, there would have to be a motion in the Senate, and of course that could very well lead to debate about things that the committees had referred to them by ministers and the merits of those subjects of inquiry and so on. In fact, the joint meetings never occurred. I don't believe one ever occurred. There may have been one or two, but after that, nobody really had the perseverance to pursue the long-term plot, so the committee system resumed its former independence. The next great step forward in the committee system was the adoption in 1988 of procedures for the regular referral of bills to committees. And that procedure has been built up over the years since that time until it's now accepted that bills of any consequence will be referred off to committees for hearings. In fact, we've now got to the stage where the government itself moves motions to refer bills off to committees the earliest possible time. They know they'll have a committee inquiry, so they want to get it operating at the earliest possible time, and they accept the inevitability of it. In fact, they've started referring bills off before the Senate even gets the bills. And in some cases, before the bills have even appeared. So anxious are they to see that this process of committee scrutiny gets underway. Now, this change was assiduously promoted over many years and finally adopted due to the efforts of that same old David Hamer that I referred to before, who was convinced that governments make lots of mistakes in their legislation, and that if only the legislation was subjected to greater parliamentary scrutiny, a lot of mistakes would be avoided, a lot of problems would be ironed out, and it would also give people with an interest in the legislation a chance to be given a hearing and also to suggest changes to legislation that could be fruitful. I've frequently been told since that he was totally mistaken in this belief, and that legislation as it emerges from government is perfect and doesn't need any of this nonsense. But that was the belief he had, and he assiduously promoted that until he succeeded in getting that reform adopted. He'd actually moved it back in 1987, and it wasn't supported at that time. Within a year, he'd managed to convert everybody to, or at least a majority of the Senate, to adopt it. The continuance of the Senate committee system has meant that at least one House is able to perform the roles that the theorists of parliamentary government and the framers of the Constitution envisaged, and has been able to hold the executive government more accountable than would otherwise be the case. And this system of committees and committee inquiries into subjects determined by the Senate and not by government has greatly reinforced the culture of independence which the Senate has built up over many years, and which goes back to the days of old Richard Baker and his constitutional framers back in the early years of the Commonwealth, and which of course has been nurtured over many years by lack of government control over the chamber. And we have to remember that over the 108 years of its existence, the Senate has not been under government control for well over half of that, and in fact, as I'll mention later, not been under government control for most of its life. A very curious little incident occurred just recently which illustrates the position the Senate has got itself into over many years. The Legislative Council in New South Wales has been, in the past at least, quite an effective House of Parliament. It's had non-government majorities over many years, and it's been quite successful in imposing accountability on successive governments, and in fact in some respects it's been more successful than the Senate. It has a very impressive system whereby if ministers refuse to provide information to the Council, they have to refer the question to an independent arbiter who then determines whether the government has any grounds for withholding the information or not. So that's been a very effective system. But just recently the Council was effectively closed down because ministers refused to attend. And due to one of those good old Westminster customs, the House can't function without a minister being present. In fact, it's even in the standing orders of some of our Australian houses. A very useful custom for and rule for governments to have. In the past also, the Council has been effectively nobbled by governments by exercising their constitutional power of prorogation. People don't know what you're talking about when you say prorogation, but all Australian governments have the power to prorogue Parliament, which is to say to bring the sittings to an end, to stop both houses sitting. And the New South Wales government has used that to close down the Council from at various times. Well, the Senate does not have any such practice that they can't function in the absence of ministers. And old Dickie Baker would never have allowed them to adopt any such rule back in the days when he was formulating the rules of the Senate. And ever since the very beginning of the Senate, it's empowered its committees to meet notwithstanding a prorogation, and they have regularly done so. So even if a government were tempted to try and shut the place down by prorogation, it couldn't stop the various Senate committees from continuing to meet. So this is all part of that different culture that the Senate has built up over many years. More than ever before, the ability of legislatures to hold governments accountable depends on getting hold of information. Information is the key to government. Knowledge has always been power, but information is more important than ever before. And one of the arts of executive government is to manage information. The principal art of executive government, in fact, is to manage information. Governments always want the public to receive only the information that is favourable to the government, and if there is unfavourable information that can't be avoided. It has to be massaged and spun to put the most favourable construction on it. And, of course, a great deal of information has to be kept secret. Well, it wouldn't be too great an exaggeration to say that nowadays a functioning legislature is essentially an instrument for getting round that information management that governments engage in and attempting to inform the public so that the public will have an ability to judge how their government is performing, and to inform the public by discovering information that would otherwise not be discovered. And it's that role, however imperfectly, that the Senate has performed with its committee system especially, and its long built-up culture of independence over many years. And I concede it is a role that's not perfectly performed, but it's performed a lot more than it is in some other parliaments of the Westminster model. At the recent 2020 summit, I presented a list of 20 parliamentary reforms that could be adopted by the incoming government. And at the top of the list was making provision for an independent arbiter to determine any questions of secrecy of information which government had refused to Parliament, so that in effect we would adopt that New South Wales system. Whenever government says it can't provide information to Parliament or won't provide information to Parliament, it's to be referred to an independent arbiter who will decide the question. That was at the top of the list. I have to say that none of those 20 proposals have been adopted. I can give you the list later if you like. And the one that was at the top of the list about the independent arbiter was the one that was most decisively rejected. I'm not planning to live as long as Rupert Loof, but even if I did, I doubt that I would see that great reform come about. But we never know. One of the problems that we're up against in this country is that any notion of independence in the legislature is not as appreciated as it ought to be amongst the public. And in fact, I think the Australian public don't make any distinction between government and parliament, between executive and legislature. They tend to think that government and parliament are one and the same thing. The government is the mob that run the country, and the parliament is that rather noisy and disreputable body sort of attached to the stern end of government, as it were. Independent upper houses not under government control are still seen as something of an anomaly. There was another recent episode that demonstrated this, but it's probably not been noticed. In our two great role models, the United States and the United Kingdom, in recent years, and since 2003, there's been an enormous amount of soul-searching about the failure of Parliament and the failure of Congress over the matter of the decision to commence the Iraq War. And great lamentations have arisen. How could Parliament be so negligent of its duties and such a weak and ineffective body as to allow the government to lead it along like that? And how could the Congress have sat there silent and allowed the administration to mislead it in this way, and so on and so forth? So great has been the pressure in the UK, in fact, that the Brown government has issued a great swag of reforms designed to strengthen and enhance the role of Parliament vis-a-vis the executive government. I'm not too sure whether any of these reforms will ever be carried out, mainly because Mr Brown might not be around to put them into effect by the look of things. But it's indicative of the pressure that he was under to solve this perceived problem of the weakness of Parliament as demonstrated by that particular episode. One of the things in his reform package is a partial, not a total, but a partial surrender of the war-making power to parliamentary determination. Similarly, in the United States, there's been a great deal of discussion about the ineffectiveness of Congress on that occasion. It didn't ask the questions that should have been asked and didn't insist on the answers, and so on. And that perception has had a great deal to do with election results in that country during that time. But the interesting point about all this is that there's been very little of this discussion in Australia. So far as I know, nobody has said... I mean, there's been a great deal of discussion about the Iraq War, of course, but nobody, so far as I know, has said, well, this demonstrates the feebleness of Parliament. Very little discussion of that at all, and this illustrates the point that I made, that there's not this perception of Parliament as a body that ought sometimes to be acting independently of government. The good old Australian Democrats, followed by the Australian Greens, revived a very old bill that they drafted way back in 1985 to provide for parliamentary approval of any warlike action by an Australian government overseas, and that bill has sunk to the bottom of the notice paper and will never be seen again, probably. Apart from that little stir, nobody has suggested that the weakness of Parliament had anything to do with that decision that's now so lamented in so many quarters. But paradoxically, as I point out to British and American visitors, our Parliament comes out rather better at that episode, because one House of the Parliament did say we want more information before we approve of this step. But of course it was ignored. Because government has the prerogative of war-making in this country under the good old Westminster system. Well, that's just a little episode that illustrates that we in Australia have a long way to go to start thinking about Parliament as an institution and something distinctive from government. I've pointed out some very positive changes that have overcome the institution over the period that we're talking about, but there have been some significant failures to change and changes for the worse. The party discipline, which is the basis of executive control over Parliament, is stronger than ever, if anything. And it's been greatly strengthened by the government techniques of information management and spin doctoring and news management and so on. Recently, a figure in the government made a dreadful mistake in some pronouncement and told me that he was taken to task by his masters, but the first thing they said to him in taking him to task was, "Don't you have any appreciation of the news cycle?" The point being that he made the statement at the wrong time in the news cycle. And then, of course, he shouldn't have made it at all, but making it the wrong time in the news cycle was the bad thing, the really bad thing that he'd done. So this constant effort by government, huge effort by government to manage the news and manage information flow has greatly strengthened the control of governments over Parliament. In the time of Tony Blair, I'm not sure whether they still have them, but all members of the British Labour Party were required to carry their little pagers. And if they said anything off message, within 2 minutes they got a buzz from party headquarters telling them to get back on message. I don't know whether they still have that system, but we didn't quite go down to that extent, as far as I know, but it just illustrates how Parliament is the loser from this new pattern of politics. And I think due to the strengthening of party discipline, we could now say that, well, a government majority in the Senate would mean government control of the Senate. We couldn't say that in the past. I think it was an accurate statement to say that up until recent times, no government really controlled the Senate. Because particularly non-Labor governments, who were in office for most of the time, after all, over that long period, could never control their senators and therefore could not control the Senate. During the Fraser government, when it had a majority from 1976 to 1981, anything up to 12 coalition senators were voting against the government on particular issues, and particularly on accountability issues. One of those issues was the establishment of the Senate Scrutiny of Bills Committee. We already had a very successful committee that scrutinises delegated legislation on civil liberties criteria, and various people, including good old David Hamer again, I have to say, but various people in the coalition said, wouldn't it be a good idea if we had a committee to scrutinise bills on the same basis and to alert the Senate whenever there was anything in bills to cause concern on a civil liberties basis. Well, greatly to their disappointment, the government decided that that was not a good idea, and the government opposed the idea, but due to their willingness to vote against their government, that reform came about as well. In effect, we've been functioning over many, many years with a parliament that's half functional. We've got one house that is very much under the control of the executive government of the day, and we've got another house which struggles along trying to do the things that parliaments are supposed to do according to the textbook in the face of constant and determined executive resistance. And we can pretty well say that that independence, degree of independence that the Senate has managed to maintain, is now entirely dependent on there being a non-government majority in the Senate, which of course in turn is entirely dependent on that system of proportional representation for Senate elections. Apart from the question of party discipline, there has been an enormous strengthening of the central power within governing parties. Years ago, as I've alluded to earlier on, Cabinet was the supreme governing body of the country and everything had to be referred to Cabinet for approval. Don't hear much about Cabinet nowadays. What you hear about is the PMO. Everything has to be cleared through the PMO. And it appears that the PMO is now the supreme governing body of the country. And that can only further weaken the parliament. We have, not to put too fine a point on it, one of the weakest parliaments in the democratic world, particularly compared with our great and powerful friends whom we like to compare ourselves with. And our parliament is under a degree of executive domination which would not be tolerated in other places, and not even at good old Westminster. There was an incident that occurred last September that illustrates this, I think. The non-government majority in the Senate passed a bill which the government was opposed to, and it was sent to the House of Reps, and the government decided to oppose the bill on the grounds that it was unconstitutional. It supposedly appropriated money, which the Senate, of course, is not permitted to do. In fact, it didn't do anything of the sort, but that was not an argument I'll go into here now. But the point of the whole thing was the Speaker made a statement supporting the government's position. A minister moved a motion to declare the bill unconstitutional, and contrary to the powers of the House in relation to financial bills, and then immediately gagged the debate. So the House was not permitted to debate an issue which supposedly had to do with its constitutional powers. Nothing could better illustrate the sad state into which our Parliament has gone. I don't think that would happen anywhere else in the Commonwealth, certainly not at good old Westminster. That sort of degree of government control wouldn't be tolerated. And just recently there was a rebellion against the Brown government in the House of Commons on a matter of parliamentary and constitutional importance. 20 Labor MPs crossed the floor, something they do quite frequently, particularly on issues of principle. And they certainly, I'm sure, wouldn't put up with that degree of government control, even in their place, which is derided by their people as being too much under the thumb of the PM. Well, lots of reform proposals are proposed for the Australian Parliament, and We have to be very wary of them because lots of them would simply reinforce the executive control over Parliament and the concentration of power at the centre, which is the actual problem with our system. But at the same time, we have to be wary of reform proposals for strengthening accountability that would be either impractical or not easy to carry out. Recently, Queensland has been back in the news again due to a minister accepting bundles of money from various benevolent persons who... I never meet people that benevolent. But the cry has gone up again, you know, Queensland is a terrible place and governance in Queensland is in a terrible state. And wouldn't it be good if we had an upper house in Queensland? And in fact, I'm told just in the last couple of days that an upper house for Queensland has been adopted as a policy by the official opposition there. But an upper house that was dominated by the same party in government with the same party discipline and centralised control would not be of any use whatsoever. The public would simply be paying for another rubber stamp. In order to create an effective upper house, somehow it would be necessary to ensure that you avoided that government control, that you somehow got members with a great interest in parliamentary accountability and accountability executive, and who were willing to take steps to devote their careers to bringing that about. Now, it would be very difficult to put something in a state constitution to say that you will have a house of that sort, and more than likely you would get unforeseen consequences if you attempted it. I don't think any drafter would agree to write a constitution saying this new upper house will not have a government majority and will have members of a great deal of independence with a great interest in accountability of government. I think that would be rather difficult to write into a constitution. So unless great effort is to be put into gaining an independent house, there's not much point in campaigning for an upper house where you don't have one. One of our departed senators, Senator Andrew Murray, a Democrat from Western Australia, would have pointed out that the key to reforming the system is to reform the political parties. And he promoted measures to reform the political parties, which would automatically lead to a better parliament. But I think that would be an extremely difficult reform to bring about in the presence or absence of Andrew Murray. Well, things are different now from what they were back in 1969, and the thing that's particularly different is that we're now, as we're constantly told, in an age of great crisis. There's an economic crisis, the worst since the Great Depression, and there's an environmental crisis that has crept up on us. What I think we have to appreciate is that in times of great crisis, the greatest danger is posed by people who come along and say, I've got the answers and you have to implement them right now. Here are the answers, rubber stamp them right now. The greater the crisis, the more likely it is that mistakes will be made by governments in attempting to deal with them, and the greater the need for scrutiny of the government's proposals based on sound information. And the legislature is the body that should be providing that scrutiny. And I said the Australian Parliament was sort of half functional before, and it's not well equipped to deal with times of crisis when one house is not permitted to make its own inquiries into the significant issues and proposals of the day, and where the other faces a constant struggle to extract information from the executive government. Times of crisis are exactly the times when we should think about reforming our institutions and reforming Parliament, and further subordination of Parliament to executive domination is more dangerous in times of crisis than it is at other times. So the proponents of openness and scrutiny should be more militant than ever before. The more the crisis deepens, the more militant they should become. Thank you very much for listening. There's a new rule applying to this lecture only, which is no difficult questions. So easy questions will be tolerated, but no hard ones. The lady with the mask. Could you go to the microphone? And just there. Just behind you. You'll have to shout. Well, that's a good story, because they threw the treasurer out of the council. That's how they did it. Funny situation in New South Wales is for the last few years, the treasurer has been a member of the council. And the council demanded information from the treasurer about various things, and the government refused to cough up the information, so they threw him out of the council. And in fact, the usher of the black rod grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and escorted him out onto the pavement. And they said, this is what we'll do to you every time you unjustifiably refuse to give us information. The government, very unwisely, advised by its Crown Law Office, took the council to court and lost the case. The Supreme Court said, well, actually, Houses of Parliament do have the power to demand information from government, and they do have the power to take remedies against governments that refuse to cough up the information. We've looked at all our old documents about, you know, parliaments going back years and years and years, and actually they do have that power. So the government lost the case, and then it was virtually forced to agree to this system whereby if they want to refuse documents to the council, they have to refer it to this independent arbiter. Who was the Premier around that time? Mr Egan was the Treasurer, who was thrown out onto the street. I think it was Bob Carr at the time. But it was not an arrangement that governments would have willingly adopted. Any other queries? Am I going to be let off so lightly? Yes, there's a gentleman at the back there.
In America, they have independent agencies like the Office of Budget, Congressional Budget. I think one option might be for, instead of reforming political parties, might be to sit down and bring in new independent agencies that are independent watchdogs against crime, corruption, and provide impartial economic forecasting and analysis. I was wondering what you thought of that.
That's a very interesting suggestion. There are actually proposals about at the moment for something like a Congressional Budget Office. There's a proposal like that in the ACT Assembly at the moment. And it's something that has been suggested from time to time. And, of course, in these times of budget crisis, it would be something very useful to have. Again, I'm not going to wait around to see if a federal government adopts it. It would be the sort of thing that governments would only be forced into. But a point I like to make is that these sort of bodies only can be effective if they have political support. And ultimately you depend on the political institutions to provide that political support. Some years ago, Mr. Kennett was Premier of Victoria, and he succeeded in getting both houses of the Victorian Parliament to pass legislation which people widely regarded as nobbling the Auditor General, rendering the Auditor General, one of those independent offices, ineffective. And that simply illustrates that sort of body, that sort of office, you know, relies on political support to continue and to flourish. And if the political support is not there, well, you know, they can't be effective. Fortunately, the Victorian Auditor General has been restored. That might tempt some people to think that the system works, you know, these things will be corrected, but I wouldn't count on that either. You have to have political support for those bodies. Any other questions? Can you go to the microphone? Or
You mentioned at the 2020 summit that you had this list of proposals, the first of which you did specify, but which was rejected. All of them were rejected, I believe. Could you give us some idea of what the others were?
Well, I can't go through all 20 of them, and in fact, I can't even remember them. So I have to refer to my notes. But number two on the list was that the houses should adopt minimum time and process standards for legislation. So in other words, they should say, we will not deal with legislation any more urgently than this. These are our minimum standards. That time limits could only be imposed on consideration of bills by agreement with the various parties in the chamber. That governments should fully respond to any amendments proposed by committees to government bills. The appropriation bills should be reframed to show us what the money is actually being spent on, something that's been controversial in recent times. And I can give you an idea of the flavour of the list anyway by mentioning those few. About five of them, I think, were adopted by the committee of the summit that, you know, prepared their report to government. But none of them have been adopted. Now, there was another questioner floating around up there. Well, this gentleman, I think, was first. He's up on his feet first, so we'll give him the first go.
Bill Rawlings from Civil Liberties Australia. You'll recall we're one of the few groups still beating our heads up against the wall on the war powers issue. But the question is the executive. The executive is this amorphous body that always overrules things. Exactly what is the executive? And does it change? Because we never quite clearly know who it is. We know where the PMO's office is. We know what the cabinet is. But exactly what do you understand as the executive?
Well, it's the combination of ministers, ministerial staff, and the upper echelons of the public service is the executive. And sometimes we talk about the political executive, meaning ministers and their staff, and sometimes we talk about the executive wider, meaning the upper echelons of the public service. Ministers' staff have changed radically in recent times. Ministers' staff now consist of great collections of political operatives who have their eyes firmly fixed on that information management role. They're highly political animals. And the public service has changed in recent years to be more responsive to government, as we're constantly told, which means less capacity or intention anyway to tell governments things that they don't want to hear. But I've always said that when people become ministers, a strange transformation of their character takes place. And they suddenly come to love power. You know, it's like that old film title, How We Learn to Stop Worrying and to Love the Bomb. They suddenly become convinced that power is a lovely thing. And if only they were allowed to exercise it unhindered, things would be much better. And that's just a fact of human nature. And constitutions and legislatures have got to impose safeguards on that unfortunate effect of power. And we have to try and develop those safeguards. Now, the lady right at the back.
We talk about power and government and all that sort of thing. And as you know, power does corrupt, has corrupted. But I think this is called the lucky country because we do have the Westminster tradition. And really, everybody's got the power they need in this country, and they don't really need just to have that president who, you have the Queen there, and she doesn't interfere. This is just the point. She's just a figurehead, and I don't see having a president is really going to help Australia at all. I like it the way it's run at the moment.
Did I say it was?
Well, you did bring up Westminster tradition quite a bit. Anyway, I believe that it's best things, as they say, don't, if it's not broke, don't fix it, is the old expression. And I really think that it is a lucky country, and we don't need the president here. We it's running all quite well.
Yes, okay. The problem is that the Westminster system changed radically. In the middle of the 19th century, you had a very militant House of Commons, which wouldn't allow governments to get away with anything. It conducted inquiries into the conduct of a war while the war was still going on, and summoned the generals and summoned the Secretary of War and grilled them about their conduct of a war which was still going on. That's how effective the Parliament was in those days. But due to party discipline, government control was ratcheted up over the years until it got to a stage where it was not permitted to control to inquire into anything without government approval. You've got lots of people in Britain who will say, you know, our parliament's just a rubber stamp, it's totally under the thumb of the government, and so on and so forth. And I say to them, well, brother, you should see ours. There was a member of the British Parliament who said he'd voted against his government 120 times or something. And I said, well, how did you get away with that? And he said, oh, my people in the constituency are right behind me. And I had, you know, 50, 100 colleagues who were doing the same thing. They can't punish 50 or 100 of us all at once. And my constituency is right behind me. All 1,500 people in my local party branch are behind me. 1,500 people in a local party branch. We do not have a Westminster system. We have something that's rather worse, unfortunately. Okay, well, time has come. One last question. One, just because you insist.
Before time runs out, we the people, to use an expression from another constitution, would like to thank you for not only giving us the series of lectures system that is of which this is one, but also for the contribution you have made over the long years, and I move a vote of thanks.
Well, there's two things I have to say. A, that was not a question, sir. And secondly, I'm going to be around for a little while longer. December is my departing time. And if I can add something else, this is not a representative body of the Australian public, unfortunately. Thank you very much once again for coming.